If you would, open up to Genesis chapter 32. Genesis chapter 32. If you look back at verse 16, real quickly to kind of get a ramp up to where we are, as this story of Jacob going home, because that's exactly what God has told him to do. As we've gone through, I think this is our fourth week in this journey home. And in looking at this story, it is a rather long tale, not as if it's made up, but the idea of, as it flows through these different events, of Laban chasing him down, and yet God protects Jacob from Laban, even sending Laban a dream to warn him not to do good or evil to Jacob. Then all of a sudden he continues on, and then he hears about a group of 400 men who's now coming from Esau, and the great distress and the fear that he has on the inside, because he knows that he didn't leave on good terms. He left as a deceiver. He left as someone who basically supplanted again a blessing that should have been to Esau, but now it's coming to Jacob. And yet he turns to God and realizes and says, I'm not worthy of all your loving kindness and your faithfulness. He says, I crossed this place with just a mere staff, and now I've come back into this land 20 years later, and there's two companies. We're so big. And look at how much is here. And if you remember, he hears this, and he starts to gather up the idea of, what if I made a gift or a present to Esau that would help appease him in maybe the anger that he might still feel towards me? And if you start to tabulate the animals of the goats and the sheep and the camels and the heads of livestock and even the donkeys, you come up with a herd that's over 550 head. This is a pretty big group. Then, of course, he has his own family. But look at verse 16. He says, he delivered them into the hands of his servants, every drove by itself. So you have about five droves if he divides them out by goats, sheep, camels, cattle, and donkeys. He says, and said to his servants, pass on before me and put a space between droves. He says, you're going to go first. Isn't that what you would hope to hear if you know that 400 men are coming your way? He says, you're going to go first. He says, he commanded the one in front, saying, when my brother Esau meets you and asks you, saying, to whom do you belong and where are you going and to whom do these animals in front of you belong? Then you shall say, these belong to your servant, Jacob. I'm coming as a servant. I'm not coming to battle. I'm coming to serve. It is a present sent to my Lord Esau. Once again, a sign of honor. It says, you are the Lord, I am the servant. Then he says, and behold, he also is behind us. And they were supposed to say that to the second group, to the third group, as they went on. Repetition. Tell them the same thing. I'm a servant. You're the one I'm here to listen to and to heed. Then, as he continues on, verses 20, he says, and you shall say, behold, your servant Jacob also is behind us. Now, think about that. You look at how Jacob's plan is going. Here's all these livestock. Here's all these different droves, all these servants. And he's saying, every time you see Esau, I want you to say the same thing. And I want you to continue saying, Jacob is behind us. You're going to see him. He's with us. Then, notice how it continues in verse 20. It says, for he said, I will appease him with the present that goes before me. Then afterward, I will see his face. Perhaps he will accept me. Look at where Jacob is in this. He's doing all this for a perhaps maybe. Maybe, just maybe, these 400 men who are coming with Esau will not destroy us. And if you think back to the earlier verses in this same chapter, Jacob's fear is that they're going to attack his wives and his children. He's expecting perhaps even bloodshed. Then, as it continues on, verse 21, so the present passed on before him. And it's the idea of the livestock and all. I mean, 550 head of livestock is not necessarily real easy to move. Now, I put a picture up here overhead, and this is a picture of the topography of Mahanaim. Now, I want you to notice how it kind of lays out in the picture. And if you're watching this on the video, I think they're going to put it up and know that you can pause that at any time and take a good look at it for as long as you like. But here, and this, of course, is a more recent picture, of course. There wasn't a fancy bridge to go across the Jabbok River. But going, you can see how the topography works where it comes down and the river Jabbok runs along the bottom. And Jabbok literally means he empties. And so you could see a pretty large group coming at you on the other side and still not be that close to them. So just kind of imagine these verses of this story in that kind of a setting. Don't imagine just a plain where there's some nice little brook that runs through it. But realize this is a river. Some of it's real easy to cross like a ford. But here as it hits, he comes to this place. And so in verse 21, he says, "So the present passed on before him while he himself spent the night in the camp." So everything goes ahead, and then here he is. Now, you know what's going on inside of him. We already know, if you think about the earlier verses, it talked about that he's greatly afraid and distressed. He prayed to God about delivering him and taking care of him through this. He says, "I'm not worthy for you to keep your faithfulness to me, but you promised that I could come back and I would be safe. You're the one who told me to come." Then verse 22 says, "Now he arose that same night and took his two wives and his two maids and his 11 children," talking about the 11 sons. We know Dinah's there as well, the daughter. He says, "and crossed the ford of the Jabbok." So you just imagine a herd of 550 plus head, because it doesn't give you the number of the colts of the camels, but more than 550 head crossing across this kind of a ravine. Then, even while it's still nightfall, he sends his maids, Zilpha and Bilpha, two wives, Leah and Rachel, and all the children. And he sends them on ahead. Then verse 23, he took them, sent them across a stream, and he sent across whatever he had. So now Jacob is the only one who's left on this side of the river. And then notice the first phrase of verse 24. Then Jacob was left alone. In the midst of anxiety and worry, now all of a sudden, he's got his plan. "I'm going to present this present. There's going to be all these servants who tell Jacob the same thing. My wives are there. Children are there. All that I have is going to be there. And then Jacob's going to be last. That's his plan." And now he's there all by himself. I don't know if you've ever had a day in your life where you knew a distressful situation is going to come to a head the next day. How well do you sleep that night? It seems to flee away from us, doesn't it? Well, here's Jacob. And so far, he's got his plan made up. Let's see how he feels about it. Verse 24 says, "Then Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. Now, we're not going to go chase it down, but as you read this, another account of this, the prophet Hosea talks about this story in a nutshell. It's just two or three verses. And in Hosea chapter 12, verses 3 and 4, if you read this story, it's not going to say that Jacob wrestled with a man. It's going to say he wrestled with an angel. Now, some people look at that and they go, "See, the Bible's inconsistent. It has all these errant statements, but what's the reality?" It's an angel in the form of a man. And so here it is, this big night. This next day is going to be pretty stressful in terms of how these things are going to go. Perhaps maybe he'll accept this present. And then all of a sudden, here you are left alone, and now you wrestle with a man in your eyes. And notice how this goes, verse 25. "When he saw that he had not prevailed against him, he touched the socket of his thigh. So the socket of Jacob's thigh was dislocated while he wrestled with him." While Jacob wrestled with the man, an angel, touches the socket of Jacob's hip, and it dislocates his hip. Now, I've been around some guys whenever they dislocated their shoulder. And I've even helped put a shoulder back in, but the doctor didn't help give me any of the money that he made that night. I may regret this, but I'm going to ask anyway. Anybody in here ever had a dislocated hip? Anybody ever had that experience? Extremely painful. And to think, here he is coming back home, and now all of a sudden he's wrestled with this man, and now his hip has been dislocated. What do you think that does for walking? What do you think that does for walking uphill? What do you think it does for crossing a river? Sound like everything just got harder? Now, he makes this statement, and if you read medical journals, you'll find out, even if you were to dislocate a hip and then put it back in place, they don't recommend that you walk for a few weeks. Even months for some, depending on severity. Verse 26. Then he said, let me go, for the dawn is breaking. Now, notice this. His hip's dislocated. He's still hanging on to this man. He says, but he said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. Jacob says, I'm not going to let you go until you have good words to say about me. Verse 27. So he said to him, what is your name? And he said, Jacob. Do you remember what Jacob means? Supplanter. Someone who takes what's not theirs. Then, verse 28, he said, your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel. You might have a footnote that tells you what Israel means. It's one who strives with God. It kind of carries with the same idea of you don't just follow, you put up a fight. And isn't that going to be an interesting name for God's people through the Old Testament? Because don't you see that on broken record? They don't always go, well, this is what God said, so let's do it. You see him go, well, let's test it. Will he really respond? And so you can understand. He says, you want a blessing? The blessing is I'm going to change your name. I'm going to change your name to Israel. He says, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed. Now you think about this. When it says prevailed, don't think about Jacob or Israel is stronger than God. Think about you have striven against God. Because if you look at Jacob's life when he was in Canaan before, was he walking according to anything that was really godly? I mean, a deceiver, someone who stole, in one sense, his brother's birthright, but really his brother sold it. Someone who dresses up like his brother so he can get a blessing. You see it time and time again, how deceptive he was. And yet, here's God who had already said, look, the descendants are going to come through Jacob. And yet, Jacob, it's not until he goes off to Paddan Aram, where Laban is, that you really see the character of Jacob do a 180. Where now he has integrity. Even whenever Laban chases him down, he gets so angry because he says, what have I done that's wrong? And yet here in dealing with Esau, you see something different. Then he says, you've striven with God, you've striven with men. I mean, is he striven with Laban? Yeah. He says, and have prevailed. He says, and yet look at you now, you're powerful. Why is he powerful? Because what did he finally decide to do? I'm going to do things God's way. And because he did things God's way, what did God do with his physical blessings? Multiplied it. Now, verse 29, still calls him Jacob. And you're still going to see Jacob used as a name as we move forward for a while. But then you'll see it switch over later. He says, then Jacob asked him and says, please tell me your name. But he said, what is it that you ask my name? It says, and he blessed him there. He gives him a blessing. Verse 30. So Jacob named the place Peniel. For he said, I have seen God face to face, yet my life has been preserved. Now, Peniel literally means the face of God. He says, I'm going to call this. So what did Jacob perceive about this man? Not just a messenger of God, but the face of God. Here he is. He says, I have seen God face to face, yet my life has been preserved. What did he expect if he saw God's face? Be killed, he'd die. And you might even have a footnote for life, and what does it say? You preserved my soul. Soul. Now, then verse 31. He says, now the sun rose upon him just as he crossed over Penuel. Now this is a different name. This means something different. Penuel means to turn to God. Here's a drastic change. Remember all throughout this story so far, you've never heard Jacob say anything about that God is his God. He says he's the God of Abraham. He's the fear of Isaac. But he's never said he's my God. He says it's time to turn to God. Now, how's his hip doing? Not too well. And then notice how that affects him in verse 31. And he was limping on his thigh. And you know it's a lot harder to climb hills like this in Mahanaim whenever your thigh and your hip's not doing so well to start. But notice this next aspect. Do the sons of Israel know this story? They sure do. Verse 32. Therefore, to this day, and think about it, to those who are reading Genesis, therefore, to this day, the sons of Israel do not eat the sinew of the hip, which is on the socket of the thigh, because he touched the socket of Jacob's thigh and the sinew of the hip. How often did they think about this story? Every time they ate an animal, they says, we're not going to eat of this, because we know what God did. And we know what happened to Israel or to Jacob. So you see these thoughts come together. So all these things are remembered. Then look at chapter 33 and look at verse 1. All of a sudden he looks up and there's something that he sees. Then Jacob lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau was coming and 400 men with him. Oh. Now, here are these 400 men, if they're coming to fight, how's Jacob doing? He can't even run for his life. I mean, nothing like going into what you perceive as a battle and going, how would I even get away? But I want you to see how Jacob has changed. Remember his plan. He says he saw the 400 men with him, so he divided the children among Leah and Rachel and the two maids, of course, Zilpha and Bilpha. Verse 2, he put the maids and their children in front. Do you think they were glad to be first? Once again, there's still a little bit of partiality here, but you'll see it's a little different too. He says, and Leah and her children, so that's Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, and then Issachar, and there's another one in there, I'm forgetting. He says, and Rachel and Joseph last. Now remember, Joseph is the youngest at this point, and going, here they are last. And remember what his fear is. That these 400 men are coming to attack his wives and his children. And remember what Jacob's plan was? Where's he going to be in this? In the very back. Boy, isn't he full of gallantry and honor. But I want you to see how he's changed. Because look at these next couple of verses. Verse 3. But he himself passed on ahead of them and bowed down to the ground 7 times until he came near to his brother. Has Jacob changed? In wrestling with the man, did it change his thinking? There he was, left alone on that side of the river. And he wrestled all night, and he realized he needed to do it different. rather than putting himself in the highest protected place at the very back. Now that he can walk with difficulty, where does he put himself now? In the very front. And for a man who's just had a dislocated hip, seven times as he approaches where Esau is, he bows down. You just imagine what that's like with a dislocated hip that maybe has just been put back into place. To bow down as you climb up one of these ravines. As he approaches Esau, he does that seven times. Notice how this continues. You remember what his big fear was? Remember his prayer? Remember the anxiety, the fear? Look at verse 4. Then Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. Was there anything to worry about? No. It was all things he had made up in his head. All that worry, all that fear, all that distress, just because he heard 400 men were coming with Esau. How often do we do the same thing? We worry and fret and fear over things when all along God already has it all worked out. If we will just follow him in faith. Here Jacob is. He finally decides to put himself last by being the first one that Esau will encounter of his family. And look at how God works it out. Here's his brother that he was afraid of. He's limping to get to him. Bows down before him as he approaches him. And his brother runs to him. Now think about that. Runs to him. And then it says, and embraced him. He hugged him. And they're the same age. He's also about 97 years old. He says, and fell on his neck and kissed him. And of course, it's not a romantic kiss. It's a kiss of what a brother would give to another brother who hadn't seen each other in 20 years. He says, and they wept together. Now, at this point in time, their father, Isaac, is 60 years older than they are. So he's 157 years old, and he's going to live to be 180. So he's got 23 more years on the earth. Verse 5. Now for this conversation. I've been waiting 20 years for it. He lifted his eyes and saw the women and the children and said, who are these with you? Almost kind of a wonder, wiping away tears as he's asking these questions. He says, so he said, the children whom God has graciously given your servant. Then the maids came near with their children, and they bowed down, just as what they had been told. The maids, verse 7, Leah likewise came near with her children, and they bowed down. And afterward, Joseph came near with Rachel, and they bowed down. And he said, what do you mean by all this company which I have met? What does all this mean? And he said, to find favor in the sight of my Lord. He says, I want to have a favorable relationship with you. Verse 9. But Esau said, now you remember this big old herd? Head of livestock, over 550 of them. Esau said, I have plenty, my brother. Let what you have be your own. I don't want what's yours. Which tells you what? Was the present what gave favor with Esau? Whose plan was that? Jacob's plan. It was a plan that was not needed. Once again, what Jacob makes up in his own mind, yet here's God who's got it taken care of. Now notice how this continues on. Verse 10, Jacob said, "No, please, if now I have found favor in your sight, then take my present from my hand, for I see your face as one sees the face of God." Now think about that for half a second. What he had just experienced, he says, "And you have received me favorably." Then take special note of verse 11. I'm going to point out a little footnote here. "Please take my," now he doesn't call it a present, what does he call it? Gift. He says, "Please take my gift which has been brought to you, because God has dealt graciously with me and because I have plenty." Now think about that. Think about how much he has. He can give away 550 head of livestock, and he's saying, "I've got plenty." Which tells you 550 wasn't the majority, probably. But he says, "Because I have plenty." Thus he urged him, and finally he took it. Have you ever done that to somebody? You almost shame them into taking what you want them to take. But here's the point, verse 11. If you got a Bible with footnotes, "Please take my gift." Does anybody have a footnote on gift? A blessing. Now think about that. Whenever Jacob left town, what did he just deceive his father into giving him? A blessing. Now, what does Jacob want to give to Esau? "Let me give you all this physical stuff." Not all of it, but here's a present. Here's a gift. And Esau's response? "I got plenty. I got plenty. The Lord's taking care of me." Because wasn't there a blessing on Esau as well? There certainly was. Chuck. Finally able to go forward. We're going to do it according to God. Then notice how this continues on. You see what these 400 men were all about. Verse 12. "Then Esau said, 'Let us take our journey and go, and I will go before you.'" He's like, I'll go. I'll prepare the way for you as we go. Could it be any more favorable? Verse 13. "But he said to him," which is Jacob said to Esau, "'My Lord knows that the children are frail and that the flocks and herds which are nursing are a care to me.'" He says, "And if they are driven hard one day, all the flocks will die." He's like, "I can't move that fast." He's like, "I can't move as fast as you do." He says, "My children are frail." And keep in mind, traveling with 11 sons who are all under the age of 12 or 13, you can understand. Then he continues on. Verse 14, "Please let my Lord pass on before his servant, and I will proceed at my leisure according to the pace of the cattle that are before me and according to the pace of the children until I come to my Lord at Seir." And Seir is 100 miles south. Then he continues on verse 15. Esau said, "Please let me leave with you some of the people who are with me." Remember these 400 men? He says, "Can I leave you with some extra servants? Some extra men to help you take care of your cattle and your livestock and maybe help you with your children, all these kind of things." Going, help at every turn. So you see the statement here. He says, "Please let me leave some of these people with you." But he said, "What need is there? Let me find favor in the sight of," you ready for it? "My Lord." Now, he's talking about Esau. He's not talking about God yet. We'll get to that in a second. Notice how it continues. Verse 16. "So Esau returned that day on his way to Seir." Verse 17. "Jacob journeyed to Succoth and built for himself a house and made booths for his livestock. Therefore, the place is called Succoth." Now, Succoth literally means booths. Probably some people I know would say, "Oh, these are loafing sheds." But the idea is it's a protection for the livestock from the heat. He says, "Therefore, the place is named Succoth." Verse 18. "Now, Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, when he came from Paddan Aram and camped before the city." Now, Shechem may not mean much to you right now, but if you were to read through the Gospel of John, when you get to John chapter 4, you remember the story of the Samaritan woman at the well? Whenever they're there, they come to a little city by the name of Sychar. And it talks about it being the place where Jacob's well was. Sychar and Shechem are one and the same. It's as if you could say, like in our terms, are you going to go to Jefferson City or are you going to go to the capital of Missouri? Well, you're going to the same place. Just two different ways to say it. So here's where he comes to. He says, Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem, Sychar, later on it'll be named also. He says, which is in the land of Canaan. He came, they camped before the city, verse 19. He bought the piece of land where he had pitched his tent from the hand of the sons of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. So here it is, 100 pieces of money. The land's been bought. And if you're reading through John chapter 4, you go, our fathers bought this land. You go, that's where that story fits into the Old Testament. Then here's what we've been looking for. Verse 20. Then he erected there an altar. This is about Jacob. Then he erected there an altar and called it El Elohi Israel. El Elohi Israel, which means God, the God of Israel. What has Jacob just claimed? God is my God. God, the God of Israel. And I am Israel. And so you start to take note. What he had said in chapters before, look back at Genesis 28. Look at verses 20 and 21. He's keeping his vow. You remember reading through this before. Genesis 28, verses 20 and 21. Then Jacob made a vow saying, if God will be with me and will keep me on this journey that I take and will give me food to eat and garments to wear and I return to my father's house in safety, then the Lord, the covenant God, will be my God. Did God keep all of his promises? Flawlessly, even in abundance. Because is he coming back with garments? He sure is. He says, did he have plenty of food to eat? Yeah, he's got so much livestock that he can afford to give a bunch of it away and still not hardly feel it. And so you see here, from this point forward, you're going to start to see Jacob not refer to God as the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac or the fear of Isaac. Now he's the God of me. He's the God of Israel, God of Jacob. And so you see something drastically different. Now, thinking about these principles, I want you to come over to 1 Peter chapter 5, and we'll finish up here. 1 Peter chapter 5. If you think about verse 5, 1 Peter 5, 5, as Peter writes to the younger men, and he tells them, be subject to your elders. Do young men ever struggle with thinking they know more than they really do? We know the truth on that one, don't we? Then he continues on. He says, in all of you. So now we're not just dealing with young men. He says, in all of you, clothe yourselves with humility toward one another. Who's up to putting the clothing on? Who's it dependent upon? We have to clothe ourselves. We're going to have to decide whether we're going to be humble or not toward one another. Or do we say, I want to do this my way. I don't care about what you want. So this is, of course, underneath the umbrella thought of doing things God's way. Then he says, clothe yourselves with humility toward one another, for God is opposed to the proud but gives grace to the humble. Was God opposed to Jacob whenever he was taking advantage of his father's blindness? When he was taking advantage of his brother's poor hunting day who was famished? He was. And all of a sudden he had to go away for 20 years and learn a lesson, didn't he? But whenever he comes back home, what's he like then? He's humble. He changes the plan even in one night. of going, let all my family go first, and then maybe Esau will be appeased with this present that I've conjured up and declared, and then maybe he won't attack us. But instead, after he wrestles with the man, now, even though he's hobbled, he gets to the front, climbing uphill all the way. You tell me that wasn't difficult and hard. Now, here's humility. And what did God show him? He showed him grace. What he feared in 400 men, his brother says, hey, do you want some extra servants for you and your children and your livestock? He says, would you, whenever he meets his brother, doesn't he embrace him and fall down on him and kiss him and hug him? And they weep together. Doesn't he show him grace? Then, verse 6, he says, if you'll clothe yourself with humility, look at what you can now do. God will give you grace. Verse 6, therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you at the proper time. He says, humble yourself under the mighty hand of God, so that at the proper time, whose timing is perfect? Yours or God's? We know it here, but do we know it here? To go, I need to wait a little bit longer here. He says, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God that he may exalt you at the proper time. And look at what he does because of humility being shown toward one another. Now the almighty hand of God will now exalt you. How stable are you whenever he exalts you? There's no better place to be. How stable are you when you exalt yourself? It's going to go down pretty quick and pretty rapid when it happens, isn't it? Then, here's where you come to, verse 7. He says, casting all your anxiety on him because he cares for you. Can you appreciate a fisherman by the name of Peter talking about casting? It is a fishing term, by the way. He says, casting all your anxiety on him because he cares for you. What had Jacob not figured out whenever he was with Laban? Before he left home, what had he not figured out? That God cared for him. But because he was wrestling with all these things in terms of selfishness, fleshliness, God was going to be opposed to him. I mean, his wages get changed 10 times. And you realize, at what point is he going to humble himself? And yet when he does, look at the grace that God shows. How does that apply to us? He says, are we going to humble ourselves toward one another? So that whenever the time is right, and who's going to decide that time? God will, not us. God will. He says, he's going to lift us up. And when he lifts you up, there is no safer place to be. You are secure. And so whenever you have anxieties, where you're getting pulled in different directions, the flesh is saying, self, go after self. Yeah, put all those kids in front of you, between you and I and Esau. You put them first. If he's going to hurt somebody, let it be them. Or is it going to be put myself last and I'll be the first one to encounter Esau? He's going to attack anyone, let it be me. And whenever he chose to cast all of his anxiety, his fear, his distress on God, did God show him grace? Is it the same or different for us? Don't we have a better covenant now in Christ than was offered under Moses in the Old Testament? These promises are so exceedingly better. What keeps us from casting all our anxiety on him? Is it because we've forgotten how much he cares for us? Did God not give his son over to die for us? What does that say about how much he cares for us? Then, real quickly, as we keep on going, If you let anxiety rule you, look at what happens in verse 8. Be of sober spirit, be on the alert. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. If you keep on going after anxiety and imagining the worst case scenario and everything, you know what it'll make you mentally? Drunk. You will not think clearly. And I'm not talking about with alcohol. I'm talking about in terms of anxiety and worry. And you won't even know enough and be aware enough to hear a lion roaring whenever he is seeking to devour you. That tells you how dangerous anxiety and worry are. In the parable of the sower, you know what it's compared to? It's compared to the weeds that choke out the word. That's exactly what worry and anxiety will do. Real quickly, keep going. Verse 9, he says, but resist him firm in your faith, knowing that the same experiences of suffering are being accomplished by your brethren who are in the world. You're not the only one going through this. Verse 10, after you have suffered for a little while. Oh, you mean you might have to suffer? You might have to go through some difficulties? The God of all grace. If you're finding grace, who is the only source for it? God is. We're talking about spiritual grace here. He says, who called you to his eternal glory in Christ will himself, notice how personal he is in this care. He doesn't outsource it to a third party. He says, will himself perfect, confirm, strengthen, and establish you. Put your name there. If you have a covenant relationship with God. Because that's what he's promising. Think about this. He says, he will perfect you, literally adequately equip you. It's the idea, it's a fishing term in terms of he will mend the nets. He'll perfect you. He will confirm you. You know what you'll see as the outcome? He does care for me. Look at how he took care of me. Then he says, strengthen you. All of a sudden, you becoming more strong, firm in the faith, because you recognize that God's in control of everything. And then he says, and establish you. And how did you get established? Because at the proper time, here you were humbling yourself under his mighty hand, and he established you, and he lifted you up. And what did you discover about all your anxieties and fears? The same thing that Jacob discovered. It was all in my head. There wasn't anything to be worried about. My only concern should be, how do I live for Christ? And cast all my anxieties on him. Because he cares for you. And he cares for me too. All right. Have a great week.